Pastors are instructed today that their sermons are to be relevant. Sermons are to be relevant in that their sermons are to address topics that are affecting the people in the church. They are to speak directly into the lives of people so that they have answers to their questions of how to address the issues that are taking place all around them. And I imagine this morning that in many pulpits across America, pastors are foregoing their typical sermons in order to address the cultural matters taking place around us. Probably many even systematic expositors who are stepping aside from their normal pattern of preaching this morning in order to address the cultural topics in the world all around us. So I intend to be extremely relevant this morning. In fact, the passage of Scripture that I have chosen today, I think, addresses directly the issues that are taking place in the culture all around us. Maybe I better say that the passage that has chosen me this morning is directly and specifically relevant to what is taking place all around us. In fact, by the end of this sermon, you will discover that the passage we are looking at is eerily relevant to what we are discussing. We are, of course, in James chapter 3, verses 13 through 18, and this morning we will be concentrating on verses 14, 15, and 16. As is my custom, let me remind you of where we are at. The first half of James's letter to the churches is the first half of the letter that he wrote to these churches designed to define the issue of faith. What is faith? What does it mean to trust in God rather than simply to profess that you have faith? And then the second half, which starts in chapter 3, concentrates on the transformative effects of faith. What are the works of faith that we are to do? If we're not to be just hearers of the word, but doers thereof, what are we supposed to do? All right, so chapter 3 begins a discussion of what we are to do. And James begins this second half by discussing the issue of language. That one of the very first things that should be transformed in the life of the Christian is how they speak. Faith for James is transformed language, one of the most significant aspects of the Imago Dei in us. It is to be transformed by faith in a regenerated heart. But now James turns his attention in the last paragraph of this chapter to a discussion of understanding and knowledge, how we apply what has been revealed to us, what has been made known to us. How do we take the information that has been given to us and show our faith in how we understand it and apply it to ourselves and more specifically to others as we interrelate with them? So from James's perspective, faith then is a transformed understanding of ourselves and others, a transformed understanding of ourselves and others. And he begins this paragraph with a rhetorical question. Who is wise and understanding among you? Now, he expects the answer to be, well, we're all supposed to be wise and understanding as those who are followers of Christ. One of the most fundamental realities of the new birth is that we now have an ability to understand the ramifications of what God has revealed. What does this information imply about the world in which we live? It's not just data, it's information and revelation that produces ramifications. But we are not only to understand, but we are to be wise. We are to take that information and apply it to our existence in ways that are consistent with the new nature within us. If indeed we have been born again by the Spirit of God, then that new nature within us should be reflected in how we think about ourselves and about others. Which leads then James to give us an imperative in the second half of that first verse when he gives an imperative for us to show our works in the meekness of wisdom, to walk in the meekness of wisdom, to demonstrate faith in God by how we apply what we know from God. Wisdom is a work of faith. It is the innate desire of the regenerated heart to use the knowledge God has given to us to demonstrate trust in that revelation. So again, one of those many imperatives that we find in this book. Walk in the meekness of wisdom. But as we turn to verse 14, James will do what is typical for him in this letter. He will turn and contrast what he expects the Christian to do by giving the opposite. He will contrast by saying, this is the opposite of this. This is what you are not to be. And that often helps us to understand what we are to be. Remember, I said this is typical. You go back just to the beginning of this chapter, back to verses 5 through 10, and he speaks about the tongue being a fire of unrighteousness, lit on fire by hell itself, using that contrast to say this is what you ought not to be as those who use language properly. So he likes using this idea of a contrast in order to help make his point. He's going to do exactly the same thing here when he writes these words, starting in verse 14. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. James will contrast in these verses then godly wisdom from the thinking pattern of the world. And this is the thesis that James has underscoring these two verses. Fallen humanity embraces a fallen form of thinking about themselves and about others, a fallen form of thinking that is utterly broken from what God has revealed, which has no place in the church amongst those who claim to know Christ. Fallen humanity embraces a form of thinking about themselves and others that is utterly broken from what God has revealed, resulting in unimaginable evil, which has no place in the church amongst those who claim to know Christ. Now let's flesh out what he says here. You will notice that James uses two words with two adjectives in the English. Two words with two adjectives. You will notice it's repeated in verses 14 and again in verse 16. So it's again, it's being hit twice by James to make sure that we don't miss it, right? Two words with two adjectives. Now, in the second example, you'll notice that the adjective is missing on the first word, but it's assumed. It's assumed, okay? The two words are jealousy and ambition. And the two adjectives are bitter and selfish. So let's talk about these two words, jealousy and ambition. The word jealousy is actually the word zelos in the Greek. We get our word zealous from this word. It means to envy, to desire. It is, if you might say, a zealous concern for what someone else has or is. A zealous concern for somebody else, what they are or what they have or what they do or whatever. Now, let me just pause for a moment and ask a question. What's the difference between jealousy and coveting? What's the difference between jealousy and coveting? If you stop and think about it, you go, they're kind of the same thing, aren't they? It's a desire for what someone else has. Well, there's a subtle difference between jealousy and coveting. In my experience, these two things are slightly different in this sense. Coveting is about what someone else has. You shall not covet thy neighbor's wife. You shall not covet thy neighbor's house. So coveting is about what someone else has. Jealousy is about what someone else is. You're jealous not for necessarily for what they have, but for what they are. Now, I realize that there is a sense of jealousy within coveting. Why do we covet the man's wife? Because how did that guy get her, right? So we look at the man and we see something in him and we say, I'm jealous of him, thus I want his wife. Or why does he get to be rich and so I want his property? Okay, so there's an element of jealousy within coveting, but there's really a distinction between the two in the sense that one is targeted at possession, coveting, and one is targeted at the nature of an individual. Jealousy then being the envy or desire of someone else for what they are, for what they are. Now, the next question I would ask is this, and this is the one that you'll go, The question here is, Is jealousy inherently evil? Now, I realize the only way we ever use the term is in the negative, right? We think of jealousy, green with envy sort of thing, as being fundamentally evil. But is it? Is it? Let me use an example from Scripture to help make a point. God calls himself a jealous God, doesn't he? Exodus chapter 20 and verse 4, in the midst of the second commandment, where God declares himself to be jealous when humans make idols and worship them instead of him. He calls himself jealous. I am a jealous God, visiting the sins of the fathers upon the sons to the third and the fourth generation. Is that evil if it comes from God? Well, it certainly cannot be, right? Since God is holy and pure and righteous, and it cannot be an evil jealousy. Therefore, there must be an element of good within it. So what exactly is God jealous of when he says, I'm jealous? If he's jealous, to jealous meaning to be jealous of what someone else is, what they are, then is it possible that he's jealous? What is he jealous of? And the answer is that God is jealous of his own nature. He's jealous of his own nature. God is jealous of the nature of himself, which he has placed into his creatures. He is jealous of the image of God that he has placed into the creature that he has created in his own image. A creature that turns away from him to another image, to something else, an idol, something substituting for him. God is jealous of the imago Dei in human beings turning away from him, the source of that image, to worship, now catch this, what is inferior to him. God is jealous of that which is perfect because he knows that the image of God in us should by nature desire to worship only that which is perfect. Everything else is substandard and inferior. God desires for man to worship the best. Not second best, the best. And so jealousy in this sense is for God to envy his own nature and the expression of that nature in humanity. As he created us in his image and placed that image within us, he then desires for us to acknowledge him as their only object of affection. He's jealous for himself. Now that's a twist, isn't it? We become jealous of what someone else is, but God is jealous of what he is as he sees that fail in the lives of creatures bearing the image he has given to them from himself. So my answer to the question, is jealousy evil, is that jealousy, when expressed as an envy of the nature of a perfect and holy God, is actually a good within us. It is a good within us to envy the nature of a perfect and holy God. What should we be jealous of? We should be jealous of the nature of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. We should be jealous of him. In a positive sense, we desire to be like him. That should be the heart cry of humanity. The heart cry of humanity is, I want to be like God in the sense that I want to be holy and righteous and pure. I know I will never be God, but I possess his image. I'm an image bearer of this God. Therefore, my desire should be to be like him, and as much as he will allow me to be as a creature made in his image. Therefore, I should be jealous of the very nature of his own Son. That's a good envy. That's a good jealousy. It's difficult for us to get our minds around that, but it's there. Now, at this point, I want to pause and insert something here. One of the most fundamental corruptions that has taken place in the fall, one of the most fundamental corruptions that took place when Adam and Eve ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is that man believed that he became, in that moment, an autonomous being. One of the single greatest corruptions that took place in the fall is the belief in the mind of man that he became an autonomous being. Man, in his fallen state, no longer sees himself as a dependent creature, but rather sees himself as an autonomous being. Isn't that what the devil whispered in the ear of Eve? God knows that when you eat of the tree, you shall be like God. And so when Eve ate from the tree and Adam with her, man fell into a condition of believing that he was then an autonomous being. And the effect of that is as follows. This corruption is to first deny the existence of a creator. The very first effect of this corruption in the human race is to deny that there is a creator. Chapter 1 of Romans, verses 19 to 23, can't make it more explicit. The first sin of man is to deny that there's a creator and then turn around and violate the second commandment again and again and again by making images in the form of animals and birds and creatures on the planet and worship them. And the greatest object of worship in humanity is myself, to worship me, because I am an autonomous being. I am God, says the fallen man. The corruption first is to deny the existence of the Creator, which leads to then denying the Imago Dei in other men. The last thing that humans want to admit is that there is a God and that his image is stamped into other men. To deny the Creator demands that you must then deny that there is the image of God in other men. In other words, now humanity sees humanity as nothing more than evolved animals. We're now evolved animals. We're nothing more than creatures like all the other creatures of the planet. Isn't it ironic that we went from being beings who were created in the image of God, set apart from the animal kingdom, and the very first thing we wanted to do was to become just an animal like all the others? Step one, deny there is a creator. Step two, deny the image of God in humanity. And then the result of that is assuming, therefore, that our destiny is entirely in our own hands. We are free to do whatever we want, the result of which becomes lawlessness in the human heart. Lawlessness. I'm free to do whatever I want to do because there is no God and there is no image of God in others. And so therefore, because I am an autonomous free creature and free to do as I will, then no one tells me what I can and cannot do. I am an autonomous creature. It is this corruption that James is considering here. That's exactly what he's thinking of here. Thus, he adds the adjective bitter to the word jealousy. He adds the word bitter. Now he makes jealousy something evil. Now he turns it from a good in us to be jealous of the nature of God into bitter jealousy, which becomes evil. And that word bitter, that adjective bitter, means resentful. Resentful. It is a jealousy towards others that is characterized by resentment towards them, a hatred of their condition, and an envy of who they are that causes one to be bitter towards them. The only other use of this word bitter, the adjective in the Greek underneath this word is found, the only other use of it is found just a few verses ago, back in verse 11. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and salt water? And that word is better just salt. And that's the word bitter. Same word. Same word. It is a tainting of our view of others. A bitter jealousy is a tainting of our view of others, such that we hate them for who they are. Such that we hate them for who they are. Titus chapter 3, Paul writes these words, "For we ourselves were once foolish, disobedient, led astray, slaves to various passions and pleasures, passing our days in malice and envy, hated by others and hating one another." There's Paul's indictment of the human race. That's what human beings became when they decided they wanted to be autonomous beings. They became jealous with bitterness. They became creatures who hated other autonomous beings. Instead of seeing themselves as creatures made in the image of God, in our fallen state, we see others as hateful beings who have what we want. I hate you for who you are, and I hate you for what you have. That's a bitter jealousy. In our fallen state, we see other humans as hateful beings who have what we want. Here's a sad truth. Everyone envies someone else. Everyone envies someone else. There's always someone prettier or more handsome. There's always someone more articulate, right? There's someone always taller or shorter, depending on your particular perspective. There's always someone younger. There's someone more youthful. There's someone wiser. There's someone wealthier. Even the most wealthy humans on this planet envy someone else for what they have or for what they don't have or what they don't have to worry about or whatever the list might be. Human beings are born into this world envying everyone around them. It is a side effect of the fall. It's the reality of living in a world in which we have decided that we are autonomous beings. Everyone envies. In other words, a good desire, seeing God's nature expressed, a good desire, seeing God's nature expressed, is replaced by an evil envy, having one's own desires fulfilled, regardless of their relationship to the Creator. This is the condition of the human race, bitter jealousy. But there's a second word that James uses, and that word is ambition. Ambition is that strong desire to achieve something, to accomplish something in some way. It's another word for it is determination, a sense of which I want to accomplish something. Now, again, is ambition inherently evil? Now, I realize that we sort of live now in a culture that says that ambition is evil. We now reach a day when we're so jealous of somebody else who actually accomplishes something that we now consider ambition itself to be a bad thing. But it's not, is it? Ambition is a good thing. It's a part, now get this, it is a part of the image of God. The Imago Dei is actually, the Imago Dei actually contains ambition. Now, how do I know that? How do I know that? Well, here's how I know that. I can give you a biblical answer to that. What did God intend for Adam to do when he placed them in the garden? Now, once again, notice I'm running back to Genesis 1, 2, and 3. It seems to be one of my favorite places to be. But what did God intend for Adam to do in that garden? He put him there and he put him to work. What was he supposed to do? And the answer was, he was to express his God-given ambition to tend that garden until it filled the whole world. We know it had small boundaries at the time, right? Because as soon as he sinned, what did God do? Booted him out. God told Adam at the beginning, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Expand that garden all the way from pole to pole and east to west. Fill the earth with the goodness of this garden. Use your ambition to go and fill this world with the goodness of Eden. Humans have within them a God-given desire to better themselves and their surroundings. We do. We very often are the recipients of other people's ambitions. Much of the very things that we possess and do and have access to are based on other people having had the ambition to accomplish that. When I started in the computer industry in 1981, some of you weren't even born in 1981, but when I started in the computer industry in 1981, the very first computer that I worked on took up an entire room. Took an entire room. It had about 20 terminals connected to it and various places in the building, but it took up an entire room. But men with their ambition came along and said, we can do better than that. We can build better computers. And this phone, this is one of the new iPhone SEs, the 2020 edition, has Apple's best processor in it. It is fast, let me tell you. This processor here in this phone, this size, is 1 million times as powerful as the computer I first sat down in 1981. It can do 1 million times more instructions per second than that first computer I used. And it fits in my pocket. And it has the bizarre ability to be a flashlight. That computer couldn't be a flashlight, but this one can. That's, my friends, is called ambition. It is a natural part of the human condition because it is a part of the image of God in us. He has placed within us an inherent desire to improve our situation, to improve our lot, to make our lives easier and better. It is ambition that causes men to go out and dig wells in places and build villages and grow crops and see poverty lifted in the world. That's called ambition. It is a good thing. But the English translation of the word requires the word selfish on the front. Now, it's not an adjective in and of itself in the Greek. The Greek word is just one word, selfish ambition. We pull it apart in English because we don't have a word in English that fits as ambition without that prefix. So we have to put the prefix, selfish. But it becomes then an ambition that is focused entirely on the self. It becomes an ambition that's focused entirely upon me. What do I get? What can I accomplish? I don't care about others. I only care about me. That's selfish. A selfish ambition in which I'm pursuing after that which I'm attempting to better myself, but at the expense of others. Doing whatever is necessary to advance myself, even if that means destroying others to get there. Even if that means wiping out other people to accomplish it. In other words, it's utterly self-centered. It is the dog-eat-dog mentality of ambition. Eat or be eaten. Ambition. So it's a good thing turned evil by the fall. A good thing that God has placed into us in the desire to better ourselves and to better our condition, which now finds itself being turned into a selfish thing, just like jealousy, which is a desire within us to pursue the image of God and His perfections, being turned into bitterness and hatred towards the very image itself in others. James says, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, if you have these things, do not boast and be false to the truth. All right, so here's where he now applies it into the situation of his readers. He's writing to a group of Christians scattered around the world, and he says, listen, he says, if you have these things in your heart, then you need to not boast about it and be false to the truth. But it's that second part that's difficult. What does he mean, be false to the truth? Well, I think the only answer that you could come up with from that, the only answer you can come up with to that, is to remember that the entire letter of James is written as a warning, isn't it? It's written as a warning to Christians, so-called Christians, people professing to trust in Christ, scattered as they are, but nonetheless professing to follow Christ. And what is his warning? Don't just claim to be a Christian. Don't just say that you're a Christian. That's not going to get you anywhere. That's not going to save you. The true Christian is the Christian who not only trusts in Christ, but knows that he trusts in Christ by the actions of his life. He proves it by the way that he lives. And that's, I think, what he's saying here. Don't go around thinking that you're a Christian if you're still bitterly jealous over others and filled with selfish ambition. Because that's not consistent with what it means to be born again. That's not consistent what it means to be born again. A warning about false professions amongst people still thinking like the reprobate, particularly in their relationship with others, being inappropriately jealous of others and pursuing selfish ends, sitting there in the pew and thinking to yourself, I am a Christian, I am a follower of Christ, but you know what, tomorrow, he's going to get it. It's inconsistent. Now, what is the source of this thinking? Verse 15. James contends that this form of wisdom, quote unquote, is not from above. Now, we're going to talk about the wisdom from above when we get to verse 6:17. That will be next week, Lord willing. But he says this is not the wisdom of above. It is the opposite of God's revelation. It's not coming from the throne of heaven. It's coming, now get this, it's coming from the pit of hell. Okay? And he describes it in three words. He says, first, it's earthly. It's earthly. It's wisdom, and again, I'm putting that in scare quotes, it is wisdom which is not coming from heaven, but it's coming from the earth. Now, in this particular case, the word could literally mean from the dirt. From the dirt. It's quite literally coming from human wisdom. It is wisdom that is evident in creatures, now catch this, without the Imago Dei. Now stop and think about this for a second. Try a mental exercise with me if you can. What would happen to a man if you removed the Imago Dei from him? What would happen to a man if you removed the image of God from him? Think about that for a second. Remember last week I said that one of the key components of the Imago Dei is speech, right? What would happen if you removed the image of God from a man? He would no longer be able to speak. He would no longer be able to process rational thought. He would no longer be able to think of things in moral categories. And the list goes on and on and on of the things that would now disappear from the man. What would he become? He'd become an animal. He'd become just a walking pile of dust. He would become the creature that God had formed from the dust of the ground in Genesis 2, that he had not yet breathed into to make a living being. That's what he would become. That's what James is referring to here when he's talking about earthly. He's talking about wisdom that comes out of human beings who do not consider the imago Dei to be significant within us anymore, that there is no image of God in us. It's wisdom coming out of men who are nothing but walking piles of dirt because they don't possess or don't see the image of God in them. This is wisdom, in other words, that sees other humans as nothing more than evolved animals, right? Second, he says it's unspiritual. Unspiritual, that's different from earthly in the sense that it's physical wisdom. It's worldly wisdom. It's wisdom, now get this, it is wisdom that is temporal in focus. Where's the focus? On the temporary, on the earthly, on what's going on in this world. It has no image beyond this world. It is a wisdom that is temporal only in focus. See, spirituality is an expression of the image of God in us by which we see eternity. How do we know that there is an eternity? It's because we see the image of God in us and we know that we are more than just the sum of our parts. We know that there is an image of God in us that makes us immortal beings. We know this because we see the image of God in us. But what happens if you take the image of God out? Then there's no eternity. Therefore, everything must be temporary. Everything is about this world. Everything is about get what you can while the getting's good. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. It's men who are living in such a way that they have no idea of eternal things, thus an eternal destiny. They don't see anything beyond this life. So it's eat or be eaten. And then thirdly, not only is it earthly and unspiritual, but it's also demonic. This is what I meant when I said at the beginning, this comes from the pit of hell. This is of the devil. This is wisdom that is based on a lie. This is wisdom that's based on a lie. For every word coming from the mouth of the father of lies is a lie. The lie that human beings are of no interest to God. The lie that they are the arbiters of their own destiny. The lie that they are free to live however they please without any consequences or justice whatsoever. Do whatever you can get away with, in other words. Now, it's a lie that was whispered in the ear of Eve in the garden, and she fell for it. But it's a lie that's been whispered in the ear of humanity from day one. There is no God. You are God. There is no consequences. There is no eternity. Go and live like an animal. What do you think the devil is trying to do with the human race? Is he trying to elevate us? Or is he trying to lower us? Do you think the devil is trying to make us as image bearers of God, which he is not, better than him or worse than him? I'll give you 5 minutes to think about it. This is the quote-unquote wisdom that encourages human beings to deny who they really are. This is the wisdom that says, I know you've been told that you're an image bearer of God, but you're not. You're just an animal. So James says that this bitter jealousy and selfish ambition that permeates the human race is not a wisdom from God. It is a wisdom from the pits of hell that is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. So what is its result? Verse 16. For where jealousy, you put the word bitter there, and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. Every vile practice. In other words, every imaginable kind of evil. That word vile, by the way, is an anagram of another word. Evil. Same four letters, just mixed up a little differently, right? Vile and evil are the same word. Every imaginable form of evil behavior. Every imaginable kind of evil that you can think of out there. Of men treating other men in ways that are vile and wicked. Murdering them. That's vile. That's wicked. Now, James doesn't produce a list here of the various vile behaviors at this point. He doesn't. Paul does in many places, like Romans 1, 1 Corinthians 6, Galatians 5, Ephesians 5, Colossians 3. Notice how many of them are included in Paul's letters. But James doesn't do that here. He doesn't bother. Why? Because he inherently understands the above. He understands inherently the above, that the wisdom of the world, which is earthly and unspiritual and demonic, is going to produce every kind of imaginable evil. And so he's not going to bother to make a list here. But he does understand this reality that naked individualism can only lead to perversion. It cannot lead to good. It never could. So it will produce every kind of vile practice. But here's where it gets eerie, my friends. It also produces disorder. And the word disorder in the Greek is another word for riot. Not only will this form of thinking lead to every imaginable practice that is evil under the sun, but it will eventually lead to riot. The place where selfish ambition and bitter jealousy spill over into violence. Take the restraints off of bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, what do you have? If your condition is nothing more than to hate everyone else because they're nothing but animals and you're only in it for yourself, and the restraints are lifted from you, what happens? The answer is akatastasia, otherwise known as riot. Listen, my friends. The fallen ideologies of this world, which are filled with bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, can never, ever produce reconciliation between human beings. Fundamentally, at their core, the thinking patterns of this world can only produce strife because they are built on the foundation of naked individualism. You will never have reconciliation amongst peoples of any kind in this world as long as their ideology is bitter jealousy and selfish ambition. There will never be a way for us to solve issues in our culture. Issues, by the way, which are not unique to our culture. They've existed in every single culture that has ever existed on planet Earth from day one. If you don't believe me, watch Cain and Abel in a field. Brother has been killing brother from the very foundation of the world. We will never, ever produce reconciliation by thinking that we can somehow figure out a way to get Mr. Selfish over here and Mrs. Naked Ambition over here to somehow love each other. They're not going to. Why? Because it's only about them. You understand this? This is a fundamental biblical anthropology. As long as men are in their fallen state of bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, they will never, ever, ever seek reconciliation with others because there is no motive for them to do so. The only solution for brokenness amongst fallen men is for them to embrace a wisdom from above. The revelation of God that all men are created in His image. Not that they're created equal, but they're created in His image. And their real problem is rebellion against him. And they see him in others. Thus, they hate them. The reason why human beings hate each other is because they look into the face of others and recognize there is an image of God in them. They're desperately trying to suppress that truth, but they know it's there. And so they hate creatures that make a claim upon them. You want to talk about a passage that's relevant to the world around us today? This is it. But the good news is that James says there is a better wisdom, and he gives us what it is. So we will leave here with that bad news today, but Lord willing, come back next week to see the good news of it. But we must think, you see, as Christians, right? We must be wise and understanding as we look around at what's taking place around us. And we must think not through the lens of fallen human ideologies, but we must think through the lens of revelation given to us by God. What's the real problem? What's really going on? That's what we're called to do here. And there's no place in the church, James says, for any selfish ideologies.